everyone, and welcome to Dark Natter, the podcast where we slice, dice, and dissect your favourite works of dark fiction. I'm John Richter, as usual, and in today's episode, I am delighted and honoured to be joined by Mark Tilbury. And I should say, actually, before I hand over to you, Mark, to introduce yourself, this is a first for Dark Natter because it's the first time that a resident of the Hall of Pain has actually appeared on the show. So, brilliant. Quite an honour. Would you like to introduce yourself, Mark?
Yeah, okay. I've been writing pretty much all my life, but not until recently, maybe 2015, I started pushing out stuff towards Amazon self-publishing. My first two books were self-published on Amazon. Then I got picked up by Bloodhound for my third novel and The Abattoir of Dreams, and they went back and republished the first two. And then I had seven books published with Bloodhound.
Yeah, fantastic.
Then I left Bloodhound and went back to indie writing, and I've just finished my fourth novel since then. So I've done 11 and thrown two away. So I've really done 13.
It's interesting actually to speculate when you've written X number of books. In reality, I suspect this is true with most writers. They've really written a few more, but those ones just ended up in the bin for whatever reason. Yeah. But I've got a couple of them as well.
Yeah.
Like sad sort of orphans or whatever you'd call them. And it's, I guess to explain a brief story of how we have met, as it were, is we've both had a stint as on Bloodhound as a publisher, as you know, been label mates in effect. And actually, when I still am with Bloodhound. I have one coming out with them that will be out by the time this episode is aired. But when Bloodhound did like a little offer for its authors recently, like last year sometime, I think, where they basically said, sort of as a nice giveaway freebie, they were giving away a free copy of a book to all of the writers, which is a nice thing to do. I said, which one would you recommend? And the lady who sort of runs the company, Betsy, the founder, she said, oh, you should read Mark Tilbury. He's right up your street. So I got one of your books for free. Completely failed to read it because I'm useless at, you have the massive towering pile of to be read.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Which is just a nightmare, the constant guilt and all that stuff. But then we had a guest on the show, going back a few months when we recorded with a lady called Donna, who is like a sort of a book influencer, a lovely person. And she recommended you as her pick for The Hall of Pain. So I thought, right, I must sort myself out and read one of Mark's books. And I did. I read The Abattoir of Dreams and thought it was brilliant. So it's an honour to finally be interviewing you in person.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
And as you say, there's another 10 to be ploughed through as well, because you've got a nice chunky collection. And I think, again, if I get my timings right, you've got a new book coming out that I think will have just been released by the time this episode airs. Maybe if you wanted to talk about that briefly.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's out on the 24th of June. It is a self-published book again, because I feel that self-publishing allows me to go where I want to rather than trying to fit in any kind of restraints set by, editors' guidelines and things. It's really the story of two teenage boys who go to army cadets, but they never show up. And obviously nobody's seen them. And the father, he's a single parent, he's a widowed parent, and he's frantic with worry. And a few days later, he gets a letter saying that I've got both your boys, Mr. Levitt. One of them must die and you choose. He's a series of horrendous, I suppose you could call them forfeits, to keep the boys alive. And it's really the story of how and why that happens, really.
And I guess how far you're prepared to go kind of thing if someone's life
lives. Yeah, it's pushing his I suppose his love to the limits and see what he can endure and just to keep his boys alive. Yeah.
Oh man. Well, sounds suitably macabre, and I would expect nothing else. So that's best of luck with the book. I hope it sells really well. And it's really interesting you mention, the whole sort of publisher versus self-publisher thing. Which I know we're digressing because we have a main topic for today's show, which we will get to shortly. But yeah, that's a really interesting one because I've had a similar experience to you. I had a couple of I've got seven books out, including the new one, two of which are self-published. And in my experience has been the self-publishing, I really enjoyed the complete creative freedom to do whatever I wanted and design, get my own cover designed and title the book whatever I wanted and sort of no interference. The flip side is I don't think I'm very good at self-promotion and I failed to sell many copies of those books. So it is that trade-off, isn't it, between the publisher's kind of promotional backing can be helpful, but you seem to have cracked it because your self-published books have loads of really positive reviews.
Yeah, I have to give my girlfriend a lot of credit for that. She's very good with social media. So
brilliant.
She's taught me a hell of a lot about how to go about it. But I think in just, just being in groups and talking within groups and, I know Donna talked about the Annies and, get a lot of interest because, they're fantastic. So I find the whole thing pretty uplifting, to be honest with you, and I feel totally in control,
Well, that's fantastic, and it is particularly, I don't want to cast this accusation at you, but I definitely can be a bit of a control freak, so I do, it is nice to have the, you don't have to sort of compromise on your vision, I guess, and it's worth clarifying for the listeners, in case they didn't hear the episode where Donna appeared, the Annies are, in effect, a self-styled group of Mark Tilbury superfans who are such big fans that they have named themselves after Annie Wilkes from Misery. So at some point, Mark may disappear and lose one of his legs. Hopefully not.
Well, they'll have to find me in the Hall of Pain.
Don't worry. We'll protect you. We'll get it reinforced. We'll make sure the door is, double-leaded and they can't get in.
Yeah. I found a lot of good people out there. Yeah.
Brilliant. Oh, that's lovely. That's really, really good. Yeah, it's interesting because you sort of, if you're newish to social media, because I wasn't even on Facebook or anything until 2017 and I got on it because my publisher said, what do you mean you're not on Facebook and Twitter? Get on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
So you're a bit like, oh God, this, everyone says social media is really toxic and it's going to be this bad experience. And I just haven't had a bad experience. I found it really nice. And most people, 99% of people, just really friendly and pleasant. Yeah.
Well, it's just exactly the same. I felt exactly the same. And I found I was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. There is an element of, like, I'm going to say lots of really opinionated political things, partly because you just don't want to upset anyone, do you? So I do get that if you were being more vocal about some of your, opinions that may be controversial, that's probably where you end up going down that route of arguing with people and getting criticised and insults flying around. But I think it's relatively easy to dodge it, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't get involved in that, but I can see how it is dividing people, shall we say. And I got my opinions, but, they're my opinions.
Yeah, correct. And the reason people are following the likes of you and me is because they want to read some dark fiction books rather than because they want to know who we voted for in the election. So I just do you know what I mean?
I don't think that anything that personal is of interest to anyone. Really.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you're right.
Well,
speaking of the Hall of Pain, we are, of course, here to follow our usual formula where our guest pitches and nominates a recommended piece of dark fiction or a series or an artist. And we discuss the work. And I act as the adjudicator to decide whether it is worthy of a place in the hallowed hall. And as I always say to any guests, just not that I'm saying, don't worry, it'll be fine, but we have let everything that's ever been pitched ever has always got in. So yes, because the quality of the pitches has always been so high, of course. and Mark, of course, even though you are a resident of the Hall of Pain yourself, you are coming today with a pitch of a different pitch for someone who potentially might join you, but I'll let you announce who you're bringing today?
Okay. Well, my pitch today is for Sarah England. She's, apart from she's a fantastic author, that goes without saying. She writes very, very dark, generally occult terror books. She goes where a lot of people wouldn't go, exposing a lot of things that are true, but, you know, bringing them into fiction. Yeah, she's got a very, very good way of drawing you into the book, you know, so you're actually, you forget you're reading her books.
Yeah, you feel you become immersed in the story.
Yeah, you become
immersed. Yeah.
Yeah, and you sort of, they're books that leave you feeling, you know, when you finish a book, well, when I finish a book, I generally forget about it. But when I read Sarah's books, I don't forget about it. I think about it. And, you know, that's the mark of a good author. And apart from she's a very, very astute lady, she's somebody that should be in the Hall of Pain, because I'm in the Hall of Pain, and Sarah would definitely help get me out of the Hall of Pain.
She'd be like a useful partner in crime, by the sounds.
Yeah, and she's got some excellent books out there, and the book I would like to sort of promote would be Babalenka, but I'm never quite sure how to pronounce that, and I've never asked because it's rude.
It's a good point, though, actually. I have I read Babalenka as my sort of prep for this show, and I'm really glad you, because I haven't heard of Sarah, so thank you for the recommendation, because the book is great. I loved it.
She's brilliant.
I'm going with Babalenka as pronunciation. Let's put stake our reputations on it.
Yeah, well, that's Babalenka is the way I would pronounce it. But sometimes I've had many of things like not so much pronunciation, but spellings of the titles of Abattoir is many and varied.
Oh God, that word, it catches me out every single time. That it's all, you know, little red underline. Oh damn it, I've got the B and the T the wrong way around.
Yeah, the
pronunciation thing is worse, isn't it? Because there might be spell checks and so on, but there's no. Well, you can find out how to pronounce things, but usually in a forum such as this, it's too late once you've committed it to recording. So, fingers crossed, we're okay.
Even whoever done the formatting for it spelled it wrong.
Oh, you're joking.
I'm not.
God, it is. Here we go. I'm going to really embarrass myself now. I think Abattoir is 1B, 2 T's, or have I got that the wrong way around?
I've written it so many times, you're definitely right.
Oh, God, that's a relief. Well, that is. Yeah, I mean, you must have had to correct that about 1,000 times. Right,
yeah,
that's really funny.
It's in a lot of reviews, and it's like, well, you don't tell people that are being nice they spelt the name wrong. But
exactly, yeah. Right. No, you're spot on. So Babalenka, what we'll do is we'll give a potential spoiler warning, just in case we cover some elements of spoilers. We will obviously try not to, because we'll talk in broader terms about the plot without giving away the specific twists. But
yeah,
you never know. And if you are interested in Sarah's work, then of course feel free to pause this show, go and buy it, read it, and then come back. So yeah, I guess Sarah's books, before we get into the specifics of Babalenka, she writes under the name S.E. England, if I've got that
right. Yeah, she does, yeah.
She's a UK-based writer of I think all of her books are what you'd call kind of occult fiction.
Yeah, they've got that thread through them, yeah.
Yeah, and I think she has 9 books, which are available in, you know, in bookstores, in paperback,
yeah,
on your email,
yeah,
and so on. She seems to have been active for a while. Lots of, even just if you look at the titles and the kind of covers of some of the books, they all look suitably kind of atmospheric and intriguing. There's one called, I think, Father of Lies, The Owl Men. I like the title of that. But some really interesting stuff. And I think she has a new one out literally earlier this year, again, called Masquerade.
Masquerade, yeah.
So definitely worth looking out for. But Babalenka is your favourite one, is it, Mark?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, it's like all books. I like them in varying degrees. But it's the one I kind of thought about a lot more afterwards, I think. And, yeah, I find it very hard to name favourite books, but Babalenka's one that really struck home. Yeah. Yeah,
and like you say, that idea that a story that stays with you afterwards and you kind of it sticks in your mind, gets its kind of claws in.
For yeah.
It's hard to explain and quantify exactly why that happens with some works, but I had a recent one. I play a lot of video games, so we sometimes talk about video games on this show. Played a game called Disco Elysium, and it's just on me every day. Finished it about a week or so ago. Keep thinking about it, keep Googling it, keep listening to the soundtrack from it. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of stuck in my head for whatever strange reason. But Babalenka is, let's see if I can summarize the plot. In effect, it's very cleverly written, really. And parallels with your own work, which we'll come back to perhaps. But it's got this thing of flitting between a present day story and the past.
Which I like that.
And again, in your own work, Abattoir of Dreams, it definitely had a strong element of that, which was really effective.
Past always affects the present, you know. So if you go back, if you start, why is this happening? I do like stories that go back to explain that.
Whereas
some people more like a more linear thing, but I do like things that chop about, as long as you don't get lost.
In some ways it became quite fashionable, I guess, at a point in time to have these, you know, Tarantino-esque kind of fractured narratives that are jumping back and forward. And
sometimes
you can get books that maybe overdo it a little bit, and you're like, what year is this now? What order is this? But I think certainly in your book and in Babalenka, that it isn't confusing. It's very clear where the action is taking place. In Babalenka, it's not just the main character who is starts off, she's a young girl and she has taken to Germany because she's of German heritage. I think in effect her mum's mum is a German woman who has died, and they have to go there for the funeral. And that's where the story kind of takes with a really brilliant opening scene that I'll come back to in a minute. But then we get not just the girl growing up, so you get that kind of childhood and then a sort of young adult life, but also we get these flashbacks to the life and childhood of the grandma, and set in like 1890. Yeah. So it almost had that element of being like historical fiction in a way, which is really
It's got all of that, and I think it's tied to what a sort of belief of mine anyway, that evil powers have always controlled the world.
Interesting.
You know, it's a sort of story that speaks, could I say, it's something I would write if I could write. I can't write that kind of way. But, you know, money and power being used to control the world the way, as I believe, that wars are manufactured rather than random politicians arguing and suddenly there's a war. I think that it's a much deeper thing and deeper evil that runs beneath all that. And in Babalenka, she sort of explores all of those angles to it. And that there's a sort of very clear message that although that she doesn't want her granddaughter to suffer, be the same. She wants to break that cycle.
Yeah, it's, and I'm really fascinated by that idea. And you touched on there about the sort of evil undercurrents sort of lurking beneath the world and you know, alternate takes on historical events. And was the truth as it was presented to us really the truth, or was something else going on? And this might sound a bit weird, but there's an element of, so I suspect, to be honest, I suspect you're absolutely right. And the vast majority of wars, to an extent, as we've kind of found out in more recent years, where at least things arguably have got a bit more transparent, they're always about money or oil or, anti-communism. Yeah. There's always some pretty nefarious motivation for why countries go to war. There's never... the UK, the US are always portrayed in the UK and US media as if we're the good guys and we're, you know, the world police, and we're, you know, trying to clean up and it's just bollocks, in it. Usually it's for financial gain or whatever.
Well, it is. I mean, without getting sidetracked too much, you know, there was an awful lot of American money funding the Nazis,
and as you say, we won't go too far down the rabbit hole, but like I went to Hiroshima recently. I went to visit Japan because I love Japan. I've been there a couple of times. I went to the museum, and you realize that arguably or potentially or seemingly factually, it would seem, the reason that the atom bomb was dropped was not sort of, oh, we must do this to end the war, and it's you know, sacrificing lots of people for the greater good. That wasn't really true at all. They dropped it because they'd spent loads of money on it, and they had to show some sort of return on their investment. Otherwise, they'd come in for political criticism for wasting all this money on the project. So they thought, oh, we best drop it then. So there's no guys. There's no good and bad.
There's not. You know, even when you go deeper than that, Pearl Harbor wasn't what it seemed, really, I don't think.
But what's interesting about the Babalenka approach and that kind of fictional take on it is, instead of it focusing on the almost kind of depressing truth of that, it sort of spins it what to me is a more fun way, which is, and the underlying evil is not necessarily just capitalism and greed. The underlying evil is actual evil and, you know, satanic dark stuff, which makes compelling, exactly. Maybe.
It's the way Babalenka's is used by them evil powers. You know, it's not that she was necessarily evil. It's that they use you. They How can I trying to put it in modern terms? You know, it's like
she's a resource.
Is such and such an evil person, or have they been used? And the more you write and the more you research, you realise that we're not living in a world we think we are.
Totally. And there's this idea that, you know, scratch the surface away, and there's some pretty dark stuff festering underneath it. I've only read one of Sayre's books, but by the sound of it, that kind of permeates all of them as a bit of a theme.
I shudder to think, and I previously would never have been drawn to books that involved witchcraft, you know, and things like that, because I'm sure they exist in every bit as much as, you know, but my sort of attitude has been slowly turned completely upside down from where I was a few years ago.
Interesting.
And so I feel, yes, I'd read about all the, you know, the Salem witch trials and all that, but I wasn't sure what that was. But I'm pretty certain that there is genuine forces of good and evil out there now. Pretty certain of that. Yes. And I think that a lot of things that were painted as evil, like witchcraft, you know, bad, nasty witches, it's all an inversion. Yeah. They're trying to shut down what we can really do. Do you see what I mean?
The powers. And it's not a subject I am very well versed in at all. But, you know, this whole, like, the word paganism can be used wrongly as synonymous with Satanism, and can be, you know, and therefore it seems evil and bad. But paganism really is all that kind of nice, natural, earth-based, you know, kind of at one with nature. And again, I'm completely getting that wrong. And
who knows? Well, it's just me. But almost every effort made by the so-called powers that be are trying to keep us from the truth.
Yeah.
So the truth is a sort of like inverted as an evil when it's the other way around.
Yeah. There's so many kind of layers to this conversation, really, but it's like we've settled. We said at the start, oh, we won't get too political, and now we have. But never mind, it's okay.
Oh no! I do sort of. It's not really because of any other reason, but I do know Sayre quite well through, not personally, but I do know her quite well, and I know a lot of her private thoughts. You know, and you know, to say
they come across in her writing, I guess.
She's a woman of my own heart. Yeah, she really does. She does get it.
It's good for people to challenge the status quo. It feels to me like where we are in 2021 is there's no real counterculture anymore. There's no protest, really. There's no punk movement. It's all like everyone's just accepted capitalism, and that's the best we're going to get, and this'll do, and masquerades as a meritocracy where if you work hard, you rise to the top and make loads of money. But actually, that's kind of bollocks. It tends to be if you get a massive, you know, inheritance, you're obviously on a much better footing. And then even the people who are self-made, you know, billionaires through modern tech companies, I mean, you know, they're usually exploiting people in workforces in other countries and overseas labor, or they're not paying people proper minimum wage, and they're using apps. And then, you know, But on top of that, they then try to pretend that they're really cool and trendy and young people love them.
Yeah.
And that all makes me a bit, you know, want to puke. So it is good to challenge this stuff, I think.
Yeah, it was something to aspire to, because everything that seems to glitter these days is corrupt, you know, but everyone seems to want the brand new Merc. They want the lifestyle, and it's not a lifestyle to aspire to, you know. So she's very much into a lot of things behind that, and you know, she has worked for the pharmaceutical industry, and she has I believe she trained as a psychiatric nurse, but I might be wrong.
Oh, so she's got
very
two,
very
no sorry
very good
Mike, I was just gonna say, yeah, she probably has, for a couple of reasons then, some big insights, one into sort of nefarious global corporate practices, and one into psychology and the human brain as well,
you know, because of her views, which I wholeheartedly hold. You know, she's not really on Facebook anymore, so it's quite hard for her to promote her books, you know, because she can't really do it very well on there.
It's very, as you say, back to our earlier thing, it is, and speaking about the ills of social media and tech, you are, as a writer, particularly if you're sort of self-published, you're lost without it. And I suppose we've got to give it its credit. At least these platforms like Amazon, Kindle, Direct Publishing, they've enabled a route to market for a lot of people whose voices might not have been heard. So I suppose we should be thankful for that bit.
Well, yeah, I suppose they're getting a little bit more draconian. They wouldn't advertise my last book because of the cover, Amazon.
Oh, really? What, you had like a dark, sinister cover and they sort of
Just a young guy crawling along a country road. I mean, it's not really...
That's weird.
It's not somebody with their head hanging off, and it's not suitable for their type of... So they're becoming more and more, we're going to tell you what to do.
That's not good. And also, I do worry then, because one of my self-published ones, I've literally got like a severed hand hanging out of a bin bag, so I wonder how long it won't be long before that gets deleted then, but never mind.
Well, they even banned one for just having a black cover with a gold lock on it.
Eh? That's weird.
Well, I know, but I do worry when they become very dominant, and as they are in the marketplace, they'll start becoming very, you can do what we want you to do, you know?
Well, we're already in that place, aren't we, of like, we have anti-monopoly laws and pro-competition laws, which is obviously the lifeblood of the aforementioned capitalist kind of model. But states can't really stop these big global mega corporations because they've transcended state boundaries. They're everywhere.
Yeah.
They're globally dominant. And they don't really care what one little poxy government is going to throw. We're going to increase corporation tax. They're like, not bothered. We just won't pay it anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it is quite a worry. But yeah, she's, I believe she's on Telegram now trying, you know, promoting her books.
Oh, well, hopefully she's able to still have some success. And we are definitely happy to promote her on here because the Babalenka is a great book. I was going to say there was one aspect to the book that I'll swerve in slightly to a different topic, but that again was certainly a parallels with your work, was this element of kind of child abuse. You know, sort of not just the flashbacks to childhood, but also flashbacks to a troubled childhood. And I guess that's something, you know, you talked earlier about things you couldn't write about. It's interesting to read other people do them, but I've never had that in my books because it's, you know, I'm lucky. It's not something I experienced. And I just think I wouldn't be able to portray it convincingly. But both you and Sarah do a great job of you know, presenting these really harrowing things, but in a sensitive, realistic way, not in a gratuitous way.
Yeah. It's a very delicate balance, I think. I think that Sarah gets it just right, personally. I think that for me, there was an awful lot in Abattoir of Dreams that I took out, you know, because books write themselves, as you probably know.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of stuff that I took out. So, yes, it is a fine balance, but I think she gets it right.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it adds, certainly gives, you know, creates the sympathy for the main protagonist, and you end up, you really hate certain characters in the books to the point where it succeeds in effect, she at one point is as a witch, almost like a trainee in witchcraft and these dark satanic powers, she's willing a hex onto a person. But at that point, I was like, yeah, good, hex him. Yeah. I hope he dies. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's the mark of a good writer, which Sarah is to actually evoke responses in readers. You want them to sort of laugh and cry and throw the kingdom. You want them to do all them things.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also rooting for the good guy to the point. I mean, I've had people say some pretty atrocious things they want to do to my characters.
Oh my God. Okay. That's
sort of remind myself, but not them, but remind myself that they're not real.
Yeah. And it's a compliment, isn't it? It's great. If yeah. people are like, your villain is such yeah. a scumbag, I'd like to torture him. You're like, yes, good.
Yeah. Well, in the same way you say about hexing someone, you think, yeah, go for it. You know, take his bloody eyes out.
Absolutely right. And you get to, you know, this is one of the pleasures of writing, is you get to create these horrible villains and then do nasty things to them and give them their comeuppance. But,
yeah, exactly. I don't know quite where these characters come from, but I do know they are really out there. They're really out there.
Well, I said in the episode where we inducted you into the Hall of Pain, your villain, I've forgotten his name, Carver, Detective Inspector Carver, or the policeman.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I hated that bloke. And I normally like the villains, but I couldn't stand him.
Yeah, I know. He didn't have one redeeming thing, did he?
Scumbag, in a good way. Great villain. There was one other thing I was going to mention in the book, which had just a very small detail, but it's so, and again, parallels with your writing, was that very convincing, because I'm Northern, obviously I'm from Wigan, and it was this really convincing depiction of pretty grim, depressing poverty, you know, 1970, yeah. I wasn't born in the 70s, born in the 80s, but it was still, you know, my upbringing was still had elements of being mired in that sort of pretty grim northern land. It's not just the north, it's any, you know, any town, any city has got the kind of poor, poverty stricken aspects. And it felt like it captured that really convincingly, like the girl when she went to move in with her parents and they were feeding her like toast with treacle on it. And I'm like, what the toast with treacle on it? What's that? Who eats that?
That's another thing I think she does well, is she can paint the pictures very well as well.
Totally.
You know,
totally.
So you actually, again, as I come back to you, rather than reading a book, you're actually living a book. You're in the book.
And there was a bit about, I think she used this a couple of times, maybe to draw a parallel between the protagonist in the 70s and the grandma in the 1890s, but there were scenes where they were in the company of adults who are much older than them and, you know, treating them like patronizing them and treating them like little kids. And there was that stilted meal where it's like you're sat at the dinner table and everyone's very silent and you're not allowed to speak because you might offend your granddad. And they were sort of chomping away on the food. And she goes into great detail of the horrible sound of this slobbery saliva drench. And I was like, oh God, that sort of sounds that's really compelling and visceral.
I first sort of saw that kind of writing with Stephen King when he was describing quite trivial things, but actually they got to you.
Yeah.
They sort of got right inside you and made you feel like you're going to puke.
Yeah.
Very, very simple things. And, I first sort of recognised that style of, I sort of call it the nitty-gritty, you know, the little things that most people wouldn't really consider. They would sort of bypass that. The meal would be the meal, or people would get dressed and they would just get dressed. But some writers can actually turn that into an experience rather than the passage of writing.
Brilliant. Brilliantly put. Yeah. And it's like you get the set. And in some ways, it's like writing 101, but it's easy to forget to do it. Is this, you know, make sure you describe the sounds, the smells, the sights that don't just, you know, he ate a meal. You can go to town on the sound that his mouth made while he was pumping away.
Or the dentures slipping a bit.
And then there's another thing there about the, so obviously it's not the fault of older people that they are older and have to wear dentures and maybe dribble a bit when they're eating or whatever. But equally, from a child's perspective, those are the sort of things that impact you. Like, you remember when you were a kid going to your grandparents' house and it kind of smelled a bit funny and, you know, it's all a bit weird and old age is a bit scary to kids. That she captured that brilliantly as well.
I mean, it reminded me slightly of when we used to visit my old nan when I was a kid, you know, and I'd always have to kiss her on the cheek and try and avoid the hairs that were sprouting out.
It sounds very familiar. It's funny what people call their grandparents as well, because there's no settled thing. There's, you use the word nan, and then some people say gran, and then some, in my family, for whatever weird reason, we didn't have a nan or a gran. We had big grandma and little grandma. But big grandma was about 5 foot two, and little grandma was about 4 foot ten. Neither of them were big, but one was just bigger than the other one. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Various stages of little.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, little and littler would have been a better description. But, yeah. And then, of course, you can use that that really effective, evocative description if she, when she then turns that to full-blown paranormal stuff. Like that then is, again, a bit of a spoiler, I guess. But there's a bit where a sort of an apparition, or, you know, is it the ghost of a grandma or whatever, first makes its appearance, and it's like this corpse shambling out of the wardrobe.
Yeah.
And we've seen, you know, a ghost or that sort of thing depicted umpteen times. It's not that, it's not a new concept. We've seen it in films, and we've seen it done well in some films. And yet she managed to describe it in a way that made it feel still quite frightening and impactful, with the, you know, broken neck or whatever. And
yeah, well, that's the whole thing. That's my biggest praise I can give any writer, is if they actually can describe something in such a way that A, it's got a slightly different angle to it, but B, you believe it, even though you might actually think, this can't be happening, you know. This is not a normal thing. But people that can describe things in such a way that you, what's the word, you abandon all reason.
Yeah, exactly. There's a thing called suspension of disbelief, isn't there? And it's like,
that's the word.
The skill. It's like, you know, it can't possibly be true, or you at least true in the conventional sense. You've never experienced, some people have experienced ghosts and so on, I haven't, but you're reading something that's clearly fiction, clearly didn't happen, but you're not seeing the artist and the craft, you're just in the story, and you believe, your brain believes that it's real while you're in there. That's what you say.
Well, that's a long time ago, I don't know, I can't remember who said it now, but it was about writing, and it was about you can have tools in the box to write, but the whole thing is just the story is the story. It's all about the story. And if you can make that the area, like you say, run down depressed areas, or the eating with the grandparents, the story becomes real, even though it's not real. And that's for me, her greatest talent.
No, most definitely. And we touched there on the kind of ghosts and all the kind of witchcraft stuff and dark powers, Satanism, the occult. And that was, there was a, although your novel, Abattoir of Dreams, was ostensibly a crime thriller, you know, about a corrupt policeman who gets his, you know, spoilers, we won't spoil the ending, what happens to Inspector Carver. But there were elements of the paranormal in your work as well.
Yeah.
And I suppose, I'm trying to phrase this into a question, maybe I'll just say a statement. It's nice to read books with paranormal stuff in, because my experience of the publishing industry is that publishers don't want you to have paranormal stuff in your books, and they try and encourage you to strip it out, which I think is sad.
Yeah. Because
paranormal stuff is interesting and cool.
And real.
There you go, nice response.
But I also, it's part of the reason I did want to go back to indie, you know. I'd done my last book with Bloodhound was me trying to write a, what you'd call a bog standard psychological thriller, and I felt, you know, it was not really, it felt a bit forced, it felt a bit, not really sure what I'm doing with this. It wasn't. I wrote another one, followed it, A Mind to Murder, and the same. And I thought, do you know what? I'm just going to go back to doing what I want to do.
I think that's, you know, that you've got to do it. It's because you're not ultimately, the reason you're writing is because you love writing and you want to write. So if you try but I'm going to write this because I think this might be more mainstream, or it might be more successful. I think it's just hiding into nothing, isn't it?
Yeah, you start getting plot formulas, you know, A plus B equals C plus D. And also, I think Bloodhound were getting a bit twitchy at that time. They were very good to start with about paranormal in the books, but I think they were getting a bit twitchy about that.
Which I can understand. I can understand why, probably, you know, their business,
it's marketing
and stuff. Exactly. And like my different publisher, but my first publisher, I ended up having to take out the paranormal element of that book.
Yeah.
And although it didn't sell particularly well anyway, I'm not going to say, oh, I told you so. There's different reasons why it didn't sell particularly well, or a bit of bad luck. But I suspect removing that paranormal element did make it a more marketable book. So I think they were probably right. But equally, I preferred the old one with the paranormal bit in. So I kind of wish I'd just sort of stuck to my guns, maybe. But
That's important, because I think ultimately writers write for themselves and then they hope other people might like it. You know, that's all.
Correct.
I mean, I don't sit down with a view in mind anymore. I just sit down with a view to do what I want to do, you know, and Sarah the same. And, you know, the good writers that I've read always want to do the same. I mean, Dean Koontz wrote one of the best books I've ever read, and he, from the corner of his eye. And, you know, it's all over the place with genres, if you want.
Yeah.
But so what? What
exactly
does it matter?
Correct. And so that this is maybe partly linked to something we were talking about before we started recording, about this podcast and the fact that it's dark fiction rather than horror necessarily. I get that there isn't so like I write books in different genres. I've got like a cyberpunk one and a crime one and some horror ones. And you do get that criticism from people who are a bit like, oh, well, you know, those all belong in different shelves in the bookshop, and maybe that's hampering your sales, John, because if you wrote stuck to one genre, then you wouldn't be confused. But there's an element of like, yeah, but I don't want to do that. I'll just prefer to write what I want to write. And then if it's successful, great. And if it's not that successful, oh well, never mind.
Yeah, well, I can't even remember. I don't quote people, but somebody I read a long time ago wasn't even an author. I think it was a songwriter. He said, you've got to make your mind up whether the what you're doing is about the books or the art. And it's always about the art.
Yeah, good. Well said. Well, it's got to be. And actually, ironically, usually focusing on the art will probably lead to more success anyway, because you're going to enjoy what you're doing and make something better in the first place. But
yeah, of course. Yeah, I definitely subscribe to that. I'm well aware that probably 99% of authors are not going to live the high life. You know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm flitting, you know, on and off being an accountant to pay the bills.
Yeah, I know. But to have sort of a body of work like yourself, like Sarah, like me, like plenty of other people, is more important than money in the bank. Because again, as we go back to that thing about the control we're brought up in, it's nothing to aspire to anyway.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And you're spot on as well. The feeling you get from, don't get me wrong, it'd be great if I was selling millions of copies of books and having...
Yeah, of course, yeah.
That'd be great. It's not going to happen. But the main thing is I feel this sense of like, you know, whatever's happening at work and whatever, any other aspect of my life, I can look at my little suite of books and be like, I'm proud of them. I'm dead happy about that. And that's the...
Yeah, well, that's it. That's precisely, I suppose, you just... you're pleasing your soul, I guess, rather than trying to please the whole world, you know.
Brilliant.
That's how I look at it. And I think there are plenty of fantastic writers out there the same, and they'll never be majorly successful. But then I look at a lot of books, without naming them, that are majorly successful, and I think, bloody hell, it's just all about the promotion, because it ain't about the content.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And that's true for films, and it's true in the video games, and it's true in any sort of artistic output that often equals the sales. And fair play, I guess that's why marketing professionals, that's a skill set that, you know, that they've got. Well, that might be a good note to do our sort of wrap up summary. If you are able, Mark, to give us like a final summary pitch for Sarah England and Babalenka for the Hall of Pain.
Okay, well, Babalenka is a fantastic story. It spans generations. It absolutely uncovers the world of evil, the way that evil powers corrupt. It explores witchcraft. It's very dark. It's humorous at places. It does everything for me that a book should do. Sarah goes to places that most writers don't go to. And for me, as a writer, that's a good thing. I think that she does that fantastically well. And I guess the main theme that Babalenka, she doesn't want Eva to be caught in that trap herself. And it's a story that kind of examines the links between the past and the present and how they can affect. And finally, I would like to say that I am in the Hall of Pain. If I wanted one person in there to keep me company, other than Stephen King, Sarah England would be the absolute perfect person psychologically, and she's just a genius.
Oh, well, fantastic, fantastic pitch. And I'm in direct communication. The Hall of Pain actually is sentient, of course, so it has its own will. And it can communicate telepathically with me, and I can confirm that Sarah is definitely accepted, happily accepted into the Hall of Pain.
Oh, good.
And we're doing a bit of a rejig. You know, the place needs sprucing up a bit. It's looking a bit dingy and rotten, and we're starting to get a few complaints.
You got two craggy old gits like me and Stephen King in there. You want something nice in there.
Yeah, we'll make sure the three of you have got cells, I mean rooms, next week.
Yeah.
So you can meet in the canteen. We need to put a canteen in. It hasn't got a canteen yet, so we'll
a
vending machine.
Yeah, I'd like Sarah England in there just to possibly also explain to me why I am psychologically bloody twisted.
Yeah, it would be nice to know, wouldn't it? It's like sometimes these, I always, you know, that trope in movies and things where there's like a kid who draws creepy drawings. So when I was a kid, that was me. I used to draw all my heads on spikes and just monsters with claws and eyeballs hanging out. Were you the same? Have you always been this way? If that makes sense.
No, I would be very much the earliest memory I've got of having anything. And no, it wasn't twisted at all. It was reading the stories of Noddy and Big Ears.
Enid Blyton, I had a bit of that.
Yeah, and I looking at my dad at the dinner table and thinking in my head, and Big Ears is sitting there eating his dinner, you know, stuff like that. But no, nothing really twisted. But I did sort of I did see a ghost and I saw some sort of things and, you know, it was a slow, slow thing, but I think it was more looking into dark stuff. It wasn't really as a child. And in my book, the child does start depicting very violent images and she paints really clearly at 4 years old. So I've always been aware and fascinated by that, particularly child prodigies, you know, that could... come out of the womb and play bloody piano concertos. You know, that's kind of weird.
There's a kid, I read something the other day where there was like a 3-year-old kid who can speak multiple languages. You know, it's like a Mensa kid who's got like multiple languages and stuff. It's just unbelievable. Like that must be a very strange existence. But
so they'll put him through him or her through school and then knock that out of them.
Yeah, just ruin it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The school system will probably convert them into a really mundane.
I do. Yeah.
No, that's really interesting. And really interesting that you've had paranormal experiences yourself, because as I mentioned earlier, I have not. So I am like the, if we would, you know, I'm the Scully to your Mulder, I guess, in this.
Well, it was a sort of a strange thing, but being alone on a long winding road, it was very late at night and I see a hitchhiker. But he wasn't maintaining his distance. He kept floating back towards me. And I can absolutely assure you, you're very lucky not to have seen one.
I'm going to say, by the sounds of it, that was a bit of a goosebumps moment, that, your description.
Well, I think at my age and bloody fitness, it would have killed me now.
Yeah. Just for any ghosts who are listening, if you could try and limit your appearances to, you know, the younger people would be nice. Thanks very much.
Don't give it to a 60-year-old.
Mark, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today for a chat. It's been a massive pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, and it's been great to talk to you, John. Thank you.
And you're very kind. And if the listeners wanted to seek out you and your work, is there any particular avenues that you'd prefer to be sort of searched on or contacted through?
Well, all my books are on Amazon. So, I mean, my email address is marktilbury59@gmail.com. That's where all people can...
Brilliant.
And there are all my social media links, but I haven't got a clue what they are.
No, that's all right. People can just search it, seek it out for themselves. But yeah,
if you just put Mark Tilbury into Amazon, you'll find all my work.
There is some bloke, isn't there, who's nicked your name, though? Some like corporate, ironically, given our earlier conversation, some like corporate business blooming self-help guru called Mark Tilbury as well.
Oh, I've had plenty of emails asking for help.
you can give them the occult paranormal.
He's a financial guru. I said, well, I thought I could help people if they wanted to be bloody poor.
That's really funny. So, yeah, just if anyone does Google Mark Tilbury and gets surprised by American sort of financial...
Yeah, I've had quite a lot of very long emails explaining their situations, all very sad, but it ain't me. I won't get you out of it.
Oh, that's quite funny. That's quite funny. But yeah, different Mark Tilbury. This is the darkest.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Mark. And
we will bid you farewell.
And hopefully speak to you again one day. And enjoy your time in the Hall of Pain, of course.
I certainly will, with Sarah and Stephen King. That'll be fabulous.
Cheers, Mark. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, John. Ta-da, then.
There you have it. That's another episode of Dark Matter in the Can. And yeah, you make a show like this and you think at some point I'm going to have a bad guest and it's going to all be a bit difficult. No, just not happened at all. Every guest we've had on the show has been brilliant and Mark was no exception. It was a lovely chat and lovely to listen back to it. And thanks ever so much, Mark. And please do make sure you check out Mark's new book, which is called One Must Die and is available now on Amazon. If you enjoyed the show, we hope you did, then please do leave us a 5-star review. That would be really helpful so we can get, more reviews. The algorithm goes, ooh, recommend that to some other people, and then we get more listeners and blah, 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 blah. So that would be really nice. And if you want to speak to us, please get in touch. The best method is probably on Twitter, where you can find us @dark_natter. And we will happily natter away with you about stuff. Otherwise, we will speak to you again in a couple of weeks for more murmurings of mayhem. And in the meantime, look after yourselves. Don't have nightmares. Or if you must have nightmares, then make sure they're good ones. Ha 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 ha.